Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice. Hello and welcome to Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is J.J. Hubel, best-selling author, cartoonist, and former special education teacher whose work blends humor, insight, and personal storytelling to explore the experience of aging. J.J. is the author of Goodbye Old, Hello Bold, a witty and thoughtful book that encourages people to rethink aging, embrace curiosity, and approach later life with a little more courage and a lot more laughter. J.J., welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
First, I want to say how much I enjoyed your book, Goodbye Old, Hello Bold.
Thank you. I love
how it's essentially a book-length visual poem. And I think as we were chatting beforehand, and I'll ask you to talk a little more about it, you know, this wasn't what you had necessarily set out to do. But the interactivity is great. It's hard to isolate any particular points, but I loved thinking about old ideas, new ideas, and radical ideas. Overall, the book is thoughtful, funny, incredibly relatable. I laughed out loud at some parts and nodded along because it's so true to life. So you titled the book, Goodbye Old, Hello Bold. What does Hello Bold mean to you?
Yes, and it's an interesting transition because there was a lot of discussion about the title. It wasn't even the original one for several reasons. One is you couldn't use the word old on a book cover for a long time. And so I started the whole project at about 72 years old, and I had the old part down, but I definitely didn't have the bold part. So I'm the perfect author. I had zero bold, so anyone can come out better than I at the beginning of this, for sure. And so to me, bold is different things for different people. Sometimes it's something very small. Sometimes it's something very large. You mentioned something radical being something that was not a big deal for somebody else. And I think a lot of the boldness, certainly listeners who are probably like me and had to step up and do lots of bold things in our lifetime that really didn't make the news, that weren't sensational or flashy, and it went unsung, unnoticed, that most of it didn't even have a name. And so I had done that, like most other people, but once it accumulated and I hit what I considered as getting very nearly old, what happened is my attitude that was usually very positive and resourceful just became hopeless. I just could not think of any options. And that's how this started. And in fact, the first two pages are a lament. I truly don't understand how this happened. This, one day I was young and I went to bed, I woke up, I was old. That's how it happens. Suddenly, without warning, you're there. And that's how I felt. And that's what started the whole project. It was really a search for bold. I didn't start it even as a book. And I certainly didn't start it with a whole pile of bold ideas. I had absolutely nothing. Most of my time was spent wallowing in self-pity that life hadn't worked out for this reason, that reason. And maybe that's, we can make it seem more positive by calling it a process of grief. I was pretty much just wallowing and whining, I think. And
that's really important to be able to self-reflect and recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think after nobody wants to spend time with you, you notice it's a pity party for one. And the other thing I've learned, particularly getting out with this book, is everybody's got a story. Everybody's got stuff. And you can't base a relationship on sharing your victim story, or at least not very long or successfully. So I think I needed to kind of hit that bottom to start searching for answers. And that's pretty much what I did.
Interesting. Well, so why do you think so many people approach aging with anxiety instead of curiosity? I love that you're focused on curiosity. That's something I think is so important to keep us engaged in life. But why do you think people do approach it with anxiety?
I think it's because we fill our minds with all the things, like I did, the negative, what didn't go right. And we also fill it with things that aren't realistic anymore. I think just a thumbnail definition of bold is facing reality and stepping up and doing what you need to do. But this is all new, uncharted territory. And one thing about our generation, because I'm going to turn 80 this year, which makes me a 1946, which is, in my view, a true boomer.
Yep. We're the start of the boomers, the leading edge.
Right. I had no idea it went to 64. So we're pioneers. There are 10,000 of us turning 65 every day. There are 2 million turning 80 this year. And in looking up statistics, I found out that in the 50s, or 1950, about 2,500 people turned 100 years old. And this year it'll be over 100,000. So there's nobody blazing the trail for us. And so for you, that kind of limits you too. Is there's the people who were first published and got the microphone on what to do when you were older tended to be celebrities or people who are very wealthy. And at least I couldn't relate to anything they said. There may be a nugget of truth, but when you examine your own resources, that's the tough part. Who's left? What's left? And does that limit you or spur you on? To a point, it spurs you, but that doesn't happen, or certainly didn't happen automatically for me. So I think that's what happens, is people get stuck in that one mode. And I think the other thing is you're overwhelmed with loss and change. And to me, all loss causes change, and even change that you pick or choose ends up with losses. And you just have fewer people. I remember writing in a journal once, I wish all the people I lost, pretty much, I'm one of those odd people that has, I have no living family left, not a cousin, not an aunt, nothing. And that's hard to wrap your mind around. And so you're really on your own. And I think facing then even the fact that other people had maybe a sister they could talk to, whatever, you're at a handicap for that. It's going to take a bigger impact if you have lost your health, if you've lost money, if you've lost people, if you've lost any type of security. All of those things, I think, keep us stuck for a while. And that's the point this book started at, with really no hope that anything would evolve. So I think that possibly is true for other people, for other reasons.
Sure, sure. So that's an interesting genesis. And, you know, you'd mentioned a pity party and you're just talking about loss, but yet you use humor when talking about aging in the book. Why is humor such a powerful tool when talking about getting older?
I think it's a powerful tool for talking about anything sensitive or difficult. And I think adding a cartoon to it adds another element, because it takes you out of a live person saying something. It's just a drawing. And And so I think humor, and certainly I can speak to a little bit to the cartoon world, is really a barometer of the culture in general. I mentioned not using old on the title. In the title, there was, and you're certainly aware of this working in media, there were thousands of attempts, some ridiculous, as to what to call all of us, because we obviously weren't going to just roll over and die anytime soon. So at first, we were called seniors, and then golden ages, and then wisdom makers, and it just got increasingly ludicrous. And nobody used the O word. It was instant death if you pitched something with that on it. And then a few years ago, right around the time when I started trying to find a publisher for this book, a couple of other people used it. And I remember seeing my first title and going, what? You mean you can use this? And as long as you're fighting that, you're never going to move forward. And so that was the one thing. It was just literally the word old. For cartoons, I can think of a couple of things. I cartoon for Cartoon Stock, which is a licensing agent that's in New York and in Great Britain. And 13 years ago when I started, it was in its somewhat infancy. Now it's owned by New Yorker, and it's grown to something quite a bit larger. But I would do whatever topic I was living, I would write it. So I did animal rescue, I did inspiring for things for women. And then I started living old, and I thought, this is what I'm feeling. And I began to submit cartoons. Now I have about 300 of them on there. But at that time, it was just new. And I can think of two of the early ones that started 13 years ago, but were only purchased for anyone to use them this year. And one was, if you picture a set of keys just laying on a table, and underneath it says inanimate object memory loss. Well, just the memory loss would have sunk the whole ship, because even I had my mother, I went through 10 years with her with Alzheimer's, but it was before we had any information about it. So people who did it back when had a different journey than ones now. Nothing is easy. But in that particular drawing, the keys are saying, where am I? Now, if somehow that had been a person, it would never see the light of day. And so, but it also didn't see the light of day for 13 years. We had to catch up to that idea. And so I want to say that one of the other ones, which was, okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
One is a couple sitting in bed and they're reading a book together. It's a huge book. And you can read the title. And the title of the book is 100 Ways to Play the Old People Card. Nobody laughed at that. It was
sure.
Number one, it used the old word. Number two, certainly revered oldies would never take advantage of this.
Sure.
That also sold this year. And one thing I never know, because of the way they do their accounting, is I know who bought it, but I don't know why. I would love to know how those were used. But what I do know is that reflects the culture where it is right now. And now you can't hear the old word enough. And because we're not writing about something we haven't. We're not even there yet. It was always younger people or even myself writing about it in my 60s. Well, that's a different person than someone who realizes they're going to live it and they're going to face those challenges. So I think it's the old humor makes a spoonful of sugar, makes the medicine go down. I posted a cartoon recently that was really pretty benign. And one of the people commented said, it's funny, but it's also sort of sad, was the aging of underwear from briefs to whitey tighties to boxers. And I thought, in a way, that is what it is. Reality can be a tough thing to deal with. I just think it was a brutal and critical step as to what is my situation and what am I going to keep? What am I going to get rid of? And once I do that and have absolutely nothing, what is there for me? So, yeah.
And nope, I think, indeed. I mean, it is a process and something that everybody, there is no playbook, as you were alluding to earlier, on how to approach it, because everybody, it's such a personal process to age. Now, you mentioned that you've been cartooning for, I think you said 13 years. And before we got on, you had mentioned that, I believe, unless I misunderstood, that you don't have any formal training necessarily in that. What sparked you? Because, I mean, clearly you're a gifted illustrator as well as writer. And again, I reference as visual poetry. It's very striking. You know, how you engage the reader, but what led you to this?
And it's interesting because I submitted cartoons for publication. Actually, even that was cartoon stock. I go back, way back to the beginning. I was raised in northern Minnesota, as we talked about, and far north and rural, excuse me, and writing and drawing funny pictures is not a value. It is nothing. that is going to be promoted or trained. I don't even think we had an art program in our school. It was a tiny little school. But the way I grew up, there were only two things that were valued where I lived, and that was physical work and going to church. Everything else was just out of the question. And so those two things have actually served me very, very well as an adult. But I always drew things. I didn't realize any of this stuff was a thing until I went to college. And a small group of us from my high school were first generation college students. And when I got there were whole departments set up that taught writing. I thought, you're kidding. And I can read and get a grade, and art departments. And I never really did pursue that because being a practical person and one with no money, I needed to get through college 4 years in three because it was just plain cheaper. And then I learned that I was a special ed teacher, and that's how I think of myself. It really wasn't, even though I've published for 5 decades, every kind of cartoon and essay and a couple of other books, I did not identify as a writer or an artist until this. And the reason is now promotions is significant. You have to use social media, and you have to identify as something. And that was very awkward for me because it's always run on parallel tracks for me. It was never the main event. But so I enjoyed not only writing, because I can write things without drawing, but I can't draw anything without it speaking and me writing it down.
It all came together for this book.
It did. And playing around with fonts, because I am non-technical, but if you click a few buttons, then it would say, getting old is a very big deal. And deal got real big. And I thought, oh, this is nice. So
that's great. So in your book, you challenge a lot of the traditional assumptions that people have about getting older. Do you think the cultural narrative around aging is starting to change? You referenced how things like using the word older and some of the other narratives are changing, but talk a little about that.
It's definitely changing, and it's most evident in the media particularly in advertising. And suddenly, I mean, I remember they make a big deal years ago. If somebody was even 50, this was whoever these models were, ooh, they're turning 50. They're practically ready for the grave. But look how beautiful they are. And now it's becoming more natural and it's becoming embedded. And I have a feeling at first it was probably financially motivated. We really control some wealth, our age group. And by wealth, I mean actual wealth, not pretend things that are leveraged to the hilt. And we're probably the last group that really saved and invested. In fact, they call it, I did a cartoon about it once, automatic wealth transfer. And of course, I take it. They get nothing. Oops. Because we're also spending it. And
absolutely.
Brand new. So things from products that are out there to the number of even celebrities. I can remember being in a grocery store seeing those sensational magazines or whatever they are. Oh, look, we caught so-and-so with no makeup. And now they're going without makeup, and it's a plus. And so we're investing less in clinging tooth and nail to old images and investing it in what next. And that's across the board. So I'm delighted to see it. It's a huge advantage for me as a person.
That's great. And you reference how the tabloids would out that's people, good. If you will, when they wouldn't be wearing makeup. But I think it's amazing how in the last year or two, I don't know exactly how long, but Pamela Anderson, who was always this sex symbol it has come out in a much more natural way. And I think from what I recall seeing in the headlines was jarring at first, but I think now people are really accepting it. And first of all, it's nobody's business to have to accept, but nonetheless, I think are appreciating the fact that she's standing up for, this is who I am. This is who I am now. And this is the real me.
Yes. And I'm glad you remembered her name, because I was trying to think of her name today, because the first time I saw it, I thought, who is that? Who are they even talking about? And she looks fantastic. I mean, I love, it's a very natural look. And there's nothing wrong with getting all gussied up and whatever sure. makes you feel good. Because some people were never allowed to do anything, particularly women and some men. It was not sanctioned to look nice or to wear makeup or to do all kinds of things. And so there's a group out there who's spiking their hair and dyeing it colors and experimenting like most people did or were encouraged to do when they were much younger. And so we've opened up both ends of the spectrum. And I see that particularly in young people, is they are not as down the middle as we are. They're not as buttoned up and they're not as wild, really. Maybe we were the last really wild generation because I think we were breaking out of so many constraints. And so I have, where I live, there's a very active and visible group of young people. There's this College of Art and Design is here. And so everyone... Yeah.
You're in Savannah, Georgia, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They are on, it's a powerhouse internationally, and they are on the street, and they are really fun to be with and look at and see.
But that is a great creative environment in which to work for yourself as well.
It is. Definitely.
So cartoons have a long history of tackling complex ideas in a simple visual way. You see it in political cartoons, single panel comics. Why do cartoons sometimes communicate complex emotions better than words alone? I mean, you referenced some of those in your history.
Right. And I think just the difference between words alone and a visual is night and day. And there's some science behind this. I've read it mostly by people who want to sell cartoons. But that we see text and now we can delete it. Before, we just could turn away. And you think of people who look through the New Yorker and they were reading the cartoons. And once they got that out of the way, then they went back maybe and read the text. And a cartoon is almost irresistible. And in the past, I could resist if you knew that a certain publication generally published cartoons that you found limiting or offensive, that you would just ignore them. But now more and more, it's embracing things that are real. When I started, primarily the primary topic for our way of looking at anything related to aging was very stereotypical. It's just a lot of wrinkles and memory loss and senior moments, and we're supposed to laugh at that. A lot of Grim Reaper, and I do acknowledge the Grim Reaper. There's a cartoon about him. calling somebody in the book, but you don't have to choose one extreme or the other anymore. You don't have to just curl up and die or go for the celebrity thing that ends up on TikTok and risk your life. And so I think cartoons, I think I mentioned, it takes the people out of it. It takes the burden of reading and trying to figure out, it takes a while to figure out if you even want to keep reading somebody's essay, but they are almost irresistible. And the fact that it's an image helps people remember it, I think.
Absolutely. No, that's that's great. Now, you've talked about some of the challenging subjects, I guess arguably challenging subjects that you've addressed, but what are some of the most common fears about aging that you've tried to address through humor?
Weirdly, if I go by what's one of the most popular cartoons, is something so simple. It's just a sign stuck in a yard, and it says estate sale. Everything my children told me they don't want to inherit. And I think I get more feedback on that than almost, and I think that's kind of where it starts because it's something concrete. But it's also a bit of an illusion because that stuff that we're hanging on to has emotional power. It represents pieces of our lives. It represents history. It represents a time that was either happy or sad. It's not just making room in a room for a new chair or because you're downsizing. And we're, as far as I know, the only country, it's possibly changed by now as we kind of Americanize the world, that has storage units.
I was just thinking that they're everywhere.
Oh my goodness. I remember I had a friend way back, I mean, decades ago, and my friend married a man who ended up making his fortune in storage units. And I thought, what's a storage unit? Do you mean like your garage or your basement? Oh no. And I thought, well, that'll never go. So needless to say, I was totally wrong. And just the concept, it's just every piece of that. I didn't think it up, and I wish I could think of who did. And they said, when every time someone dies, it's like a small library burning down. It's a famous quote.
Interesting. I'll have to look that one up. I'm not familiar with that.
Yes, I'm so sorry. I can't think of it. And I thought, well, every time a person dies, another thing happens is your history goes with it. But if your photo albums get lost during a move, something more than a pile of photos got lost. And I think, so that's sort of where I see people starting. And then once they get into that, then you can go after the more difficult subjects, trying to control your image, trying to regain something from the past, investing all your time and money with groups and events that really no longer have any meaning for you. And once you start emptying out, there's space then for new. By that time in the process, you're looking for new things. I don't even bring that up because it didn't happen for me till about 3/4 of the way through all of this. I actually wrote the most about the away. And that's what I was stuck with, particularly stuck between fear of the future. It's interesting. That's what you say. And longing for the past to come back. I just want all of them to come back and help me deal with this. I want the good old days that I'm, of course, only remembering the really positive nostalgia part. And I had to do that by moving back to northern Minnesota, trying my hardest. And it took me years to realize everybody is gone. And the cemetery that I'm walking through way too often, every one of those people is just as dead as the first time I walked in that cemetery. And I think for me, it took literally doing that and recognizing how I was then stopping any positive input. Who would want to be around that? I'm not reading books about new things to do because I'm looking to kind of promote my theory of, didn't I get a bad break here? And so, yeah, I think literal is the easiest to start with and then morph to the other more difficult things to face.
So, you've had a storied career, but it sounds like you almost had an epiphany at some point and changed your mindset. If I'm understanding you correctly, that, you'd referenced a pity party early on in our conversation, but from the time that we've spent thus far, you're a very positive, energetic person. How did you turn that around? If I may ask.
Yes. And I think the epiphany, there were probably multiple epiphanies, signs this isn't working, but an epiphany happened when I was reading just one of those. Do you remember a few years ago, or even more now, probably 10, 8 years ago, it was a big thing about loneliness is worth 15 packs of cigarettes a day or some astronomical thing. And I thought, oh, great. Why don't I just take up smoking? Get it over with. I don't have a prayer. And so they would have these little tests. And one was you make a target with blank, and then you're going to fill it in. And in the middle was, well, who would you call if you really an emergency? They would just, come like that. And then the next one, well, you'd call to have a good time. You call if you felt bad, and on. Mine was empty. I looked at it and thought, how did this happen? And that's where I truly don't understand how this happened to me. Where are not only all my people, but where is my spirit? Where is anything positive? But that was so concrete and so in my face. And that's where I started. And just got up and went someplace comfortable. I thought, it doesn't even matter where I go. It just needs to be somewhere, not here. right in this spot, because I am just sitting here sinking, you know, in the Pilgrim's Progress, one of my favorite books, John Bunyan. And he has the Slough of Despond. Well, I was there and I didn't want the ladder. You know, I'm just going to slosh around in there. And so for some reason, that really hit me. And then I wrote the first part with no hope. And then every time I wrote another page, it was a little more and a little more. I am a person, I mentioned church being important. Faith is my grounding thing. There were the stupid years when I made bad choices and want nothing to do with any of it. But that's how I ground myself. And this project and my life more now than ever starts every morning at 4. I'm a real early riser because I'm an early to bedder, which I'm finding out the more I say that in public, lots of people are.
Absolutely.
They hide it. I said, call me at 4 in the morning. But it's the same, and it's been the same for years. It's me and God and coffee and the cat.
That's great.
Anything I read is going to be uplifting in some way. I love books by people who've overcome something, and not in a Hallmark type of way. I love people who admit how hard it was and admit to cheesy parts of themselves that don't make themselves look very good, because that's actually probably what most people can relate
Absolutely. To. Absolutely. Yeah, and that really is important that we as humans are honest with each other and with ourselves. And I appreciate you sharing that. That was a very kind of vulnerable personal story, but I appreciate you, you know, sharing that with me and with our listeners. Because I think there are a lot of lessons in there. So do people react differently to serious topics when they're presented in a lighter or more, you know, playful manner?
Oh, I think definitely they do. These subjects were first taboo, and then secondly, a wave of, oh, I did it, you know, you can too, because whether you can relate to the person or not. And then once research started happening, now you get into the serious tomes that really don't provide you with anything usable. I'm a very practical person. I don't like frivolous things. I like to be able to, I want to take home I can use immediately. I really don't want to. I remember one of the first and really peppy women I met who lived like this, and it was way before I think I was probably 35 and she was in her 60s. And I remember saying, are you going to that workshop on whatever it was? She said, no, I don't want to learn another thing. And what she meant was, I'm done learning. I need to start using. They're just going to tell me something that either I already know or is not, has nothing to do with my life. And so, yes, I think humor, I was actually you can't stop thinking about next project or whatever. And I was thinking about when the 100 ways to play the old people card sold, I thought, you know, there really are some perks to getting old. And, you know, I started listing those, and they're funny, but they're real. So I don't know. Do you want to hear?
Sure.
I actually dragged it out.
Absolutely.
It doesn't. This is how far it's.
Oh, interesting.
Not even to the typewriter. So it happened to me. I realized it quite a few years ago, but it was in Savannah, was voting. I can't tell you what time. Is it always November? But it seemed like it was a special election. Standing outside. And the reason I say that is, if it was November, it was really hot. And we were standing in the hot sun. So you know I'm not standing in northern Minnesota. And just dutifully waiting in line. And a woman came out, one of the poll helpers. And she said, if anyone's over 70, you can come in with me. I went, boom, that's me. I was treated like a VIP. You can sit down. They have water. They explain the whole thing. I thought, okay, this is really working. And so that's sort of how it started. And I said, voting lines, you can skip ahead and they treat you as a VIP. TSA took away that whole thing now about your shoes coming off and that. So everybody gets to do it now. you get discounts on everything. Buses kneel, all our buses here kneel, and people leap up. Of course, it's the South, so manners are quite something.
Sure.
And they leap up to give you a seat, even if you are sitting in front of a sign that says, give the seat to elderly. Yeah. Shame-free napping. That's
love that.
A must. And anything passes for exercise. And what I'm saying is, I like all the chair things, but apparently I'm really building my biceps and so on. And that's wonderful because I've used them. Anyone who's had a fall no longer makes fun of chair exercises. And so for me, I'm still able to walk, and I walk every day. It's a beautiful walking town, and I'll walk a couple of miles. At first, I couldn't, but I do. And when I tell people, younger people, that, they're sort of shocked. And I have to remember, oh, yeah. They're thinking, wow, she walks? And gee.
That's wonderful.
And last one I'll share is cursive writing is now secret code. They are hiring people, younger people, because they can't read a handwritten will and they kind of want to know what they got.
I never thought about that. That it's one thing not to be able to write, but not to even be able to understand it. Now, there was a bill, and I'm not going to have all of the details right, but here in Pennsylvania, they introduced, it was either an executive order or a bill to reintroduce cursive into the school system. And it's interesting how that is having a resurgence, because I remember, I mean, my handwriting isn't great, but I remember learning cursive. And of course, you had the little cardboard things on across the top of the blackboard. But so
yes,
interesting.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm sorry.
No, please.
Oh, I was going to say, one cartoon I did recently was just two talking heads. And the woman is saying in her bubble, I got a new job, and it's I interpret cursive writing, and they pay me. It's better worded than that. And the person who's supposed to be listening to her said, I wonder what she said.
That's great. She was thinking in cursive.
Right. So
that's wonderful. So you mentioned that you've sold these, and you don't necessarily know why people have bought them, but do you know what they're being used for? Are they greeting cards? Is it for publication in a magazine or some sort of a book? Or I'm just curious.
Yes.
That world of syndicated cartooning.
Right. And it's, you do know what purpose they state, because that's how they are charged. They have a one-time use, and it can go from personal to business use with so many viewers and a blog or and a book and so forth. And it's kind of the honor system. And so
yep.
It works and it doesn't. Because I usually, because they have the name and they don't, I have no idea what they do, but I know what the cartoon's about. So if the cartoon is about aging in place and I Google the person's name and aging in place, you can usually kind of narrow it down how they used it. And so do I know for sure how they used it? I really don't. But financial advisors use them a lot, because I do a lot about inherited wealth and video wills and people leaving things to other people. Lots about downsizing. Adult children coming home is a huge topic and kind of loaded for a lot of people. It's very emotional. So my intent on those tend to be somewhat absurd. The couple standing outside and the kid shows up with all his stuff, his skis and a dog and everything. He's going to think he's coming home. And they said, oh, we'd love to have you move back in, but we really downsized. And you can see the back of the house. It's just up on stilts. There is no house. All they have is a facade. And so, that's, I think, where humor makes people go, oh, we've got to do
something. Just turns reality
this
on its ear.
Right.
Yeah. That's great. So you've spent years using cartoons to reflect everyday life and the experience of getting older, as we've been talking about. Have you ever had readers or a reader tell you that one of your cartoons helped them see aging differently? Do you have that kind of feedback with your readers often?
And you know, that's what's nice about now, much as I am stumbling through social media. Back when was sold, and I had won the series of books. It's still selling, and it sold 1 million copies. I have no idea who bought it or any. I didn't. There was no public face of me. There were no talks. There was nothing. And I've been astounded about that. Only when I started this book, The Goodbye Old, and promotion came on board, I love meeting the people. I love giving a book talk because they ask questions at the end. And mostly people come up afterwards and they will share something that it made them think about, that they think prior to my talking and putting it out in the sunshine, they maybe thought they were the only person. I think the most, and even at book signings, the most reaction is to the first two pages. Because even after I say, I don't know how this happened, that second part, anyone who says it didn't happen in a different way or that getting old is no big deal is a liar, liar, pants on fire. Getting older is a very big deal. And that is about as bold as you can make that statement. And I decided to stick with that boldness because it's not a harsh boldness. It's just the truth. And if people wouldn't see that themselves, they're probably not going to like the book.
Sure,
So yes, that I would say the first two pages of the book are the things I get the most reaction to, because the cartoons, otherwise I'll never hear back from the people.
So, right. Yep. Interesting. So this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to as you age? Obviously, you've kind of had a reset button in the last 8, 10, 12 years, mm-hmm. whatever it's mm-hmm. been. But, you know, now that you have this really positive outlook, not that it was completely negative before, but now that you have this positive outlook, this new momentum, what are you looking forward to?
Boy, more than anything, valuing friends, meeting new people, having new people come on board. I certainly had no clue how important that would be and how satisfying. And in the way of being a little discerning, be careful what you say, be careful who you invest time in. It sounds like a duality, but it's not. You have to be careful. How many viable years do I really have left? I don't have a lot of time to make big mistakes with and end up with unbalanced relationships. There's no crystal ball, but by stating things truthfully, whether it's this book or really what you're all about, good and bad, you're going to attract and keep people who agree. I'll give you one big example of that. And other, maybe I go to bed very early, and I kind of always had. It's gotten a little extreme now. I'm going to try to tweak it just a little bit and be semi-normal. And I had a friend who said that she would answer invitations to dinner or any evening event with, if I get home after 8 o'clock, the answer is no. And I thought, that pretty much sums me up. I'd have to say that's really true. I will do it to accommodate certain things. I'm not a prima donna, but it's not my choice. I'm a breakfast person, brunch, lunch, and not so much on the other end. And I heard Jamie Lee Curtis wrote about that.
I was just thinking that.
And she said, I go to bed at 8, I get up at 4. And so did Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen, who he married. And I thought, yes. And what I'm finding out is that more than anything has, you can't be my friend if everything you do is going to be in the evening. We're wired differently. It's a different circadian rhythm. It's not a problem. I just know I'm going to be disappointing and frustrating to that person. So I think just tell the truth about who you are without going too far, any kind of bragging or really playing a victim and all nothing but sadness. Somewhere right down that middle is the truth. And that's the only way to test the waters. If you tell a room full of 10 people that, 9 of them say, she's not my cup of tea, you just saved yourself a whole lot of time and sadness, really. It's no fun to get dumped by people.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. And you can be casual friends, but you
yes.
feel a sense for who you really want to invest that time in, because friendship is an investment.
Yes, it is. Very, very much.
So, you know, many people do reach midlife or retirement and ask, what's next? What do you think, or why do you think reinvention is such an important part of aging well? You know, having, as we've been talking about, reinventing yourself. Why is that so important?
Well, of all the times we don't want to be closed up, this is it. I alluded to, we don't have a whole bunch of chances to make some of the missteps we made. And the fact is, those aren't even choices we're making now. I think the biggest choice is to embrace the possibility of those changes and plan for it. If it never happens, it never happens. It's not negative. I've heard people say it's so negative. It's not negative. The other is Pollyanna. And I have met so many people who won't do any of this, and they're going to be shocked, like me, when I looked at my friend chart that was completely empty. You don't want to wake up, then something has happened to you, and you hadn't even thought about it yet. We can't prepare for every possibility. But I'll give you a good example. Years ago, I didn't even know I was thinking about it so much. I was probably late 50s, early 60s, but on the brink of buying another house. And I thought, oh, you know, I had a friend who had fallen or something. And he said, boy, those stairs, that's really a problem. And I thought, oh, I'm going to go to one of those companies that sell those lift things for stairs. And he showed me all about what works, what didn't, and roughly how much it was, how you could install it, and so on. And he said, there are two kinds of people I meet in this business. One is a very small group like you who checks way ahead of time. The larger group checks when they need it today. Then they find out it won't work with their stairs. It won't work with their situation. And it's too late.
And it becomes a crisis.
A real crisis. And then you end up having to make choices to get care for somebody, yourself or a loved one. And then you find out about waiting lists. And so I think be preemptive, face the real issues that are very likely coming. We may be living longer, but we are the guardians of that quality. And surround yourself by people who are moving forward in spite of it all. Doesn't mean they have their head in the sand. Far from it. Once you've gone to the stair place and found that out, I can forget about it. I don't have to keep thinking about it. So it takes that off my mind and I can do something fun.
Sure. No, that's, I think, wise words and great advice. But what other advice do you have for people who feel stuck or unsure about their next chapter? I mean, that was very practical advice, but how would you encourage someone to get unstuck?
I think for me, where I had no people to go to, I think I turned to books, podcasts, anything, anyone who's doing anything. And one thing you'll discover is there's a large segment of younger people addressing these same issues, because this is not a process that just happens at a certain age. It happens when you finally realize that you are no longer going to be taken care of by some other people. And about your third forever home should light up something in your mind that there is no such thing, and that you're going to have to keep doing this over and over and over and revisiting it. And I think because the nature of our losses and changes at an older age are so comprehensive, they just bleed into every aspect of our life. So if you are fired at 20, whatever, you know, you think you can do anything, and you probably can go get another job. You're fired at 60. That's not so easy. And so I think that's the thing. It's just whether you're sailing along and everything is hunky-dory, change happens. And so already begin to put that idea in your head preemptively. And even when I do talk to young people, and when I do, I have two piggy banks. And I say, you're at a stage where you're investing in this piggy bank, the career, the family, the new house, the fitness, and all of that. Be sure you're investing in this other bank at the same time, which is the more long-term friends that are going to hang around. Fitness should morph into healthy lifestyle and good nutrition. Finance should be not just living on a credit card, but what is going to enable you to stop working if you have to stop working, and begin to just visually, again, oh, it's always going to be visual with me, is to visualize those two piggy banks, and they need to have the same amount in them, and it'll kind of come and go, but that will serve you in the end. So.
Yep. It's all about balance. But so your work suggests that aging can be a time of growth rather than decline. What do you think helps people embrace that mindset of growth?
I think having a success, stepping out and doing almost anything and having it work. Once I stepped out, changed my attitude about life, really, and myself. I attracted a friend, shock. And the friend is still a friend to this day. And I will say, too, if the step is just out your door, that's why I am a big believer there is no one size fits all whatsoever. Paula Deen is from Sudan, and I certainly don't know her or anything, but the world knows her. And in her latest, talk about reincarnation, or, you know, reinventing what I know, you know, there can be some differences of opinion, but the point is, here's a woman who made it to be very successful, whatever. And her mission is to shine a light on agoraphobia and say that big personality and that big hair and that come on in, y'all. There was a period of time where going out the door was extremely hard for her.
I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
And by somebody who's given the mic, so many people are given the mic and they just, it's me, 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 me. But she didn't have to do that. And lots of other people have stepped out. The women I read about, the men I read about, have overcome something. They didn't have to be public. But once they saw that, that they were given that, then they decided to share that. And every person that does that frees up untold numbers of other people. Take some tiny step. And that's huge for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I
think that is, you know, so critically important. It's just getting started. And yes. I mean, you know, you've written books. I've never written a book, but in other projects I've done, sometimes just getting off that proverbial blank page, or in your case, that literal blank page, is such an important step.
That's right. And to give yourself credit for the step, because I stepped out. This book went to 44 publishers who didn't feel like I did. And I have boxes of projects, like you probably do too, that were pitched and never saw the light of day. It hurts and it's hard. And sometimes people have betrayed you, or you feel rejected. But you have to remember, at least I stepped out. At least I stepped out. I'm not going to, people can Monday morning quarterback because they haven't done anything. And so if nothing concrete ever happens, and I have a friend who said, whatever it is you're supposed to be doing, your calling or the purpose of what you're doing, never happens specifically related to that project. Often it happens because of it. You meet somebody, you see another opportunity. And I think that's so important. We don't know what's out there. We only see, as they say, through the glass darkly. We see tunnel vision. We do not see the big picture. And if we could, maybe we'd be sad, but maybe we'd be stunned at what doors are out there just waiting for us to quit looking at the one behind us.
That's really well said. So how do you think people can stay curious and creative as they get older? You know, we often talk about creativity, that's something really for younger people. And many artists that I've read about and talked to say that their most interesting work actually happens later in life when mm-hmm. they have more perspective and life experiences. But how do you think people can stay creative?
Well, if you can't do it on your own, you would say, because there are people who say, I'm just not a creative person, but sign up for something or other that is surrounding you with people who are creative people. I am able to attend classes at one of the art museums because someone told me they don't audition you and anyone can join. And what's interesting is who is in that class. is a painting class, and I'm the only one that I painted, and I really didn't like painting. And so they allow me to sit there and draw silly things and write words. But the other people in the class, some of them are seasoned artists, but most of them are not. One was a retired attorney who is very funny, and he would say bad things about his own art, and it was a release for him. Another person was probably the most successful CEO I've ever met in person. And I thought he's all focused on doing the still life, like the teacher said, and it's a tremendous outlet for him. And so I think quit thinking about creativity in the very literal sense that has a judge and a jury, and go find something where you can just be with creative people who won't compete with you. And that isn't everybody. Sometimes people teach writing or art, and they're kind of competing with you. I don't think any of us need any more negativism. We're not trying to be professional anything. And so run if that's what you encounter, because it's never going to get any better. And so look for a group that's uplifting. And if you sat there and did nothing, it washes like it does for me. The fun, the music in the room, our teacher is lovely, and the other people just feed my soul, whether I produce anything or not.
Terrific. Terrific. So you've spent decades observing human behavior through writing and cartoons. What have you learned about how people handle change? How do they handle change?
Well, probably the two poles are they just retreat. I have a globe that I drew on the front of the book. And that's, I wasn't thinking about it at the time, but you see those people are flying off of that globe. Because if you do not fly off, that globe's going to get smaller and smaller, and pretty soon it's going to be you watching Netflix in your bedroom. And that's happened to people. And it certainly happened to me. It just shrinks very fast. The good news is it gets big much faster than it took the years to shrink. That is a slow process. That's how insidious it is. You even realize it's getting smaller and smaller until it's pointed out. Like somebody wants you to go to dinner at 7 o'clock, right. You think, maybe my rules are a little tight. And so if you'd never interface with anybody, it will just slowly shrink your world, and you get more and more used to it and more fearful. Whereas once you start to step out, it gets bigger, and it gets bigger real fast. When I first went to the museum, it was just the art class. And then I met a woman who said she was going on a trip. And I said, how did you do that here? I was looking for a local group that would go on local trips because interesting area. And she said, well, I joined this newcomers club, and anyone can join, you can do it. And it was just a lifesaver, just sitting in a room with 100 other women my age. And nothing said you had to be that age. There are some younger people. And hearing their stories and eating lunch with them and seeing the potpourri of offerings that were for small groups. And suddenly I had places to go, I'll tell you, on a Monday morning.
I love that.
Because they had a breakfast club. I didn't have to try to stay awake all day so I could go to something for dinner. And I just thought, I have now died and gone to heaven because I had choices. But it happened because I went to an art class, not because I was looking for that. And that has led to other things and other things and other things. That's what I'm saying. We have to evaluate our own vision as tunnel vision, like looking down a cardboard tube at best. We don't have a clue what's out there when we're thinking from a shrunken world perspective.
I think that is so important because it would be easy to go into some of those scenarios and just see it at face value, but being open to the possibilities and you know, allowing yourself to go there, I think is really, really pretty important to consider.
Yes. And allowing is an understatement because I went through some pretty serious challenges, and it lasted really a good long time that left me with some things I didn't like a tough time sleeping. And so there would be days when I hadn't slept at all. But I told myself during my little morning devotional, these legs are still going to go. I am going to that if I have to drag myself up those. And I did, because the alternative was to look in the rearview mirror and go back to something I knew wasn't working. And I also knew this very important fact: there was absolutely nobody was going to do this for me. If we're waiting for someone to do it for us, or the right encouraging words, and this person's really going to step up, that's nice if those things happen. But I had to say, I have to make this happen. Nobody is going to rescue me. And many, many times I went to the newcomers meetings on a couple of days of no sleep, instead of just thinking I was going to catch up during the day. You're not. You need to get out there. And so people have different things that are unwelcome about them, that those are real challenges, and they really have to not just pretend they don't exist, or they're going to even go away. I'll have that the rest of my life. I have to factor it into my day and decide what's just accommodating it in a reasonable sense and what is just pandering to it, and try to not pander.
So are there certain attitudes or habits that seem to help people age with more resilience?
Yeah, that can-do spirit. And I think more than anything, looking at what you need to let go of. So often it is really the useless hard place of fears that may not even be real, and some idealized former way of being. And I think when I drew a lot of pages in the Away chapter, and some of them are a little tough. Every one of them is, virtually everything in the whole book is something I experienced. When I was reading to a group and I said, get a restraining order, is one of the possibilities, sort of rolled their eyes. But virtually everything was either thought by me or a friend, or I experienced it in some way. But if you are continuing to feed things, we experience a lot of grief as we're older. It's just part and parcel. It could be for things, for people, for ourselves, for some anything. But usually it's for people. And there are ways, and there's a million ways to grieve, and we all do it differently. I kept mine in forever, ever, ever. And that walking through the cemetery, at last I cried. And that's because there was nobody around. Other people cry very easily, but they don't move forward. And so I think the question I asked is, what I'm doing, any of the things I had in that section of the book, am I keeping something alive, not honoring it by looking at these photos every day? And now, of course, we have videos. What could be better than to listen to missing people talk to you? And can I do that and move on? Or, and what I've seen is, that's used as something that's, they cling to, someone will cling to.
Almost an anchor.
I did. Exactly. And I did it in my mind, but people can do it literally, set up almost shrines to people, again, either literally or in their mind. And none of that is a bad thing. I have my dog's ashes, and I really needed to walk through the cemetery. But if that's all I think of, and that is stopping me from clearing that space to the possibility, if I am able to honor and really miss that person and wish with all my heart they were back, at the same time, move forward and honor what's left of my life without them as well. That to me is one of the toughest transitions, at least it was for me. And it's not going to get less, because every year we're alive, there's fewer and fewer people that we know. And that's why it's so critical to get new people on board, not just to take up those spaces, but to mutually encourage that kind of exploration.
There's a lot of wisdom packed into what you've shared in the last little while. So thank you for that. But, you know, I appreciate all the time that you've given. Down to the last question. So what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
Probably the cliche that's all going to go very fast. But I think almost my two pigs thing came from the need that I thought about the future because I came from very practical people. But the problem was the future that they prepared for didn't happen. People left earlier than they should have. Life was disrupted. You invested in other kinds of relationships that didn't work out exactly. And once that keeps happening, some people goes pretty smoothly, their life plan, but mine didn't. And it went so fast, I could never catch my breath and catch up. And so I would say to my young self, face reality all along the way and invest wisely in both piggy banks.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, JJ Hubel, it's just been a delight to talk with you. You have such good energy. I really appreciate it. And it came through in your book, but certainly came through in our conversation here. So thanks. I thank you for that. Okay. Really appreciate you joining us today.
It was wonderful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I'm Derek Dunham. I'd like to also thank our producer, Dave Schaffner, and our engineer, Matt Campbell. We'll see you next time on Roundtable Talk.